27. Dobbs Ferry, New York, August 19, 1781. Dawn. George Washington is on the move. It is a summer Sunday morning as the Continental Army breaks camp and assembles for the march. 3 miles to the east, a French army does the same, soon to link up with the Americans. The great day has come. At long last, the combined armies will march away from the fields and valleys they have called home these past 2 months. The soldiers believe they will soon be fighting in New York City, but that is not the case. General Washington has long been focused on capturing the city. Just 2 months ago, British spies intercepted a letter from Washington to the Marquis de Lafayette in Virginia. Lafayette has used his small force well, harassing Lord Cornwallis's army so completely that the British behave like a force in retreat, burning all in their wake as they pull back to the more populated cities near the Virginia coast. George Washington was pleased by Lafayette's success, but regretted to inform the dashing young general that the combined forces of the Continental Army, French Army, and French Navy would be used in expelling the enemy from New York, not in providing help for Lafayette in Virginia. Undeterred, Lafayette followed up with another missive. "Should a French fleet now come into Hampton Roads," the Marquis implored, referring to the mouth of the James River, "the British army, I think, would be ours." Still, Washington steadfastly clung to the belief that New York was the best option. That would soon change. Curiously, Washington did not write that letter to Lafayette in code, nor did he entrust it to an express rider. Instead, he mailed it by regular post. Not surprisingly, the British acquired it. General Clinton in New York City was so ecstatic about possessing the American plans that he paid the mail thief 200 guineas as a token of his thanks. Footnote: approximately $34,000 in modern currency. End footnote. The British Army began preparing for the coming American invasion of New York. Now, as George Washington watches the majestic might of the combined American and French armies sally forth to do battle, that blunder seems inconsequential. With about 12,000 troops under his command, Washington has switched his strategy. Much has changed. Alexander Hamilton has finally left Washington's staff and has been assigned to command a battalion of light infantry. Lafayette has pushed Cornwallis all the way back to the Atlantic, and most of all, Washington has just received news that a French fleet of 29 warships carrying 3,000 additional Marines is sailing north from the West Indies to support the American cause. There were two stipulations to the French naval assistance. The first was that the ships must leave the American coast no later than October 15th to avoid winter storms. But it is the second demand that was most consequential. Although Washington is very much the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, the French are now the ones making crucial decisions about where the next great battle will be fought. There are two places for an offensive against the enemy: the Chesapeake and New York, French General Jean-Baptiste Rochambeau has written to his naval counterpart, Admiral François-Joseph Paul de Grasse. "You will probably prefer Chesapeake Bay, and it is there we think you can render the greatest service." The suggestion pleased de Grasse, for his decision to sail for America from his home base in the West Indies has left those islands undefended against British naval invasion. Virginia being closer to the West Indies than New York, the admiral opted to follow his colleague's advice. Accordingly, Washington's entire force now swings south toward Virginia, some 550 miles away. "An army is a machine whose motions are directed by its chief," one soldier will write of this day. The British fully expect George Washington to attack New York City. The notion that he would move his entire army south, leaving New England and West Point naked in the face of a British attack, is so extreme as to be absurd. But Washington is now convinced that by going to Virginia, he can trap Cornwallis and the British army in a snare: the Continental forces confronting them by land, and the French Navy by sea. The moment is critical. the opportunity precious, the prospects most happily favorable. I pray that no supineness or want of exertions on our part may prove the means of our disappointment, Washington will write of what lies ahead. Footnote. From a letter to Governor Thomas Sim Lee of Maryland, dated August 27, 1781, supineness is a word for inertia, apathy, or passivity. End footnote. Lord Cornwallis is equally confident of victory. From his new base of operations in Yorktown, just 30 miles up the James River, the English commander awaits the arrival of the British fleet. In addition to the marauding services of Bannister Tarleton, who has joined Cornwallis in Yorktown, a task force of 19 ships with a combined firepower of 1,400 guns is now sailing south from New York City to aid Cornwallis's infantry. The firepower should be more than adequate to protect Cornwallis and his 7,000 men, and will continue to show the wisdom of his Virginia strategy. It is here where Cornwallis plans to win the war. "Now, my dear friend, what is our plan?" Cornwallis writes to a fellow general. "Without one we cannot succeed, and I assure you I am quite tired of marching about the country in quest of adventures. If we mean an offensive war in America, we must abandon New York and bring our whole force into Virginia. We then have a stake to fight for, and a successful battle will give us America." It is September 12th when George Washington says goodbye to his beloved Mount Vernon home. He has left his army, which continues to march to the Virginia coast, and allowed himself the luxury of a brief stopover, visiting his home for the first time since 1775. The general means to stay just one night, but the comforts of sleeping in his own bed and seeing Martha, and of standing on the porch looking out at the Potomac River, have kept him here for two. Yet, for all the nostalgia this visit has brought forth, Washington is anxious as he leaves his estate behind. The French fleet still has not materialized. Without naval firepower, there can be no assault on Cornwallis's positions. Impatient and eager, George Washington races to Yorktown. There is no time to waste, for he has less than 1 month before the French fleet's October 15th deadline, the date when they will sail away, should they ever arrive at all. The general has no illusions about the future of America's independence. Once again, the nation is beggared by apathy. His troops are not being properly fed, clothed, or paid, and as a result, enlistments are tumbling. Yet, as always, George Washington finds a reason to hope. "We are at the end of our tether," Washington writes to John Laurens, a compatriot of Benjamin Franklin in Paris. "Now or never, our deliverance must come."